Welcome to Holden Village. Tonight, Ingrid Christiansen will be speaking on reimagining our life partnerships. So let's listen in on Ingrid.
I chose those words fairly carefully, reimagining, partly because I think that we imagine that we know how to do life partnerships. And we imagine that it's all kind of a commonplace. You know, that maybe we will do what our parents and grandparents did, or maybe we will do what our culture teaches us to do. But if you look at that at all for 2 seconds, you see that there's a problem there, because things have changed so fast and are changing so fast, and we're not sure a bit that they worked for our parents and our grandparents, whatever their norms were. My grandmother, for example, was widowed. She wasn't married until she was 32, and then she had 4 children and was immediately widowed. And so she couldn't have said, well, I'm going to have a white picket fence and be cared for by a husband who will raise money for this family. She had to put herself back through school and support those kids and put them through school. And then she got so much out of being an independent person like that that she went to Europe alone the last time when she was 92. So, and she was twice elected to public office. This is Eleanor Bew, I should say. Twice elected to public office before women had the right to vote. She said she would campaign outside of bars because women couldn't go in bars either. So our heritage. Every one of you could tell that story about somebody in your family. Our heritage is much richer and more diverse than somehow we are given to believe by our culture. There's a sense that things used to be one way and now they're some other way. Don't believe it. I don't think it's true. So I want to get some of those stories from you today, and we'll find out what we've inherited or think we've inherited in terms of commonplaces about how to build life partnerships. But we will also take a look at some kind of practical ways to redo them, do them in different ways. And through them, I will turn for wisdom to bits out of these books that I have laying around here. And I'm going to begin with one out of this wonderful book called Cries of the Spirit, A Celebration of Women's Spirituality. I bought it in the Holden Bookstore a couple of years ago. Denise Levertov's poem, Prayer for Revolutionary Love. That a woman not ask a man to leave meaningful work to follow her. That a man not ask a woman to leave meaningful work to follow him. That no one try to put Eros in bondage, but that no one put a cudgel in the hands of Eros. That our loyalty to one another and our loyalty to our work not be set in false conflict. That our love for each other give us love for each other's work. That our love for each other's work give us love for one another. That our love for each other's work give us love for one another. And that our love for each other gives us love for each other's work. That our love for each other, if need be, give way to absence and the unknown. That we endure absence, if need be, without losing our love for each other, without closing our doors to the unknown. I think some of the hardest work we do in relationships is being open to the unknown. And that's hard to put on any list and say you can't build a good relationship without allowing the unknown in there. But boy, I sure resist it. I want my partner to stay the same. You know, I partnered for this person as I thought he was, and by golly, that's how he should be. And of course, he's not the same. So that brings me to the next thing I want to say, which is that this, I want to say a disclaimer. I don't think I know that I'm not an authority on this subject. People have asked my husband and I to talk about it from time to time, so we've given it some thought, but I'm not an authority. And I think every person in this room is an authority at the same time. We are all authorities on how to build good relationships. So I would really like this to be a brainstorming time. I would think it would not be very helpful for us to to find one another's suggestions incorrect. I have a couple questions. Let's just quickly throw out some responses to these. In a marriage or a partnership, and I'm using that consciously because I know that there are different kinds of life partnerships represented in this room. There are gay and lesbian life partnerships, there are conventional marriages, there are men and women who are together in committed relationships who are not married. So I think we need to use a little broader language than the language that any one of us might bring to this space. But in those, what do you think are the givens? What have we been given in terms of how to do this together, specifically to start with, by our church, by our faith, by our religion, by some sense of what we think is what we've been taught by the church? People have suggestions there or ideas? What does our religion tell us about a good way, about what we should do in partnerships?
We should love each other as Christ loves the church.
Pretty good advice. Others?
Forgive.
Forgive. Right. That's hard to do. For me, at least. How about the sort of down a layer or two? What in your home church when you were growing up would someone have gasped at or frowned at in terms of how people treated one another in relationship? What were the kind of unspoken mores that you got from your community or your church in conjunction with your community?
One is faithful.
Excuse me?
One is faithful.
One is faithful, exactly. You be faithful. So these kind of modern commuting relationships would have been frowned on. He lives in New York and she lives in Chicago. They see each other every other weekend. Others?
The Ozzie and Harriet syndrome for happy.
Yeah. I pay attention to the statistics on those things from time to time, and you see every so often how many American families are the Ozzie and Harriet family now. A husband, a wife, and 2.5 kids, or whatever it is. And I think it's about 21% of all families now, all statistical family units living in houses and apartments across this land. So it's less than a quarter. But still, it's what we think we're supposed to be like. It's the tradition, it's the received wisdom.
I think one of the things I remember from my church upbringing was something sort of negative in a way. It was every time, as a child, they taught us the Ten Commandments, when they got to the part about adultery, the teachers would always just push right over that one and would say, well, your parents will talk to you about that. Well, they never did.
Right.
And it's as if it was what the church did say about relationships more than what they did say.
Very good point. Excellent point. I think that's very true for lots of people's upbringing. God knows what adultery is. I mean, we never were told, right? Actually, I was. I went to a place, a church where our senior year in high school, Pastor Oscar Anderson, who was the head pastor in that church, taught a senior Thursday school release time class called Marriage and the Family, and it was fabulous. He was a big shot head pastor, and he took us seriously as kids, and boy, was that a gift. I really think that if your adult, your sort of senior level pastors would take those almost adult kids seriously and talk to them about some of these issues. I think I have a lot of opinions about what the Lutheran Church should do more of in the area of sexuality, because I chair the board for the Division for Church and Society, and that's the division of our church that put out the sex statement, so I've been thinking a lot about it in the last years. One of the things I think our church, the Lutheran Church, at least the ELCA, does not do enough of is teach us about marriage, about tough times in marriage, and how to do marriage, and what a long-time partnership should look like and be made out of. And I think it doesn't do enough with its teens. I think the kids are kind of written off. We think, oh, they're too disinterested in what we have to say these days, and I don't think that's true. So thank you, that's a good point. Anybody else?
I grew up with in church, got pregnant, and then got married, and it had the baby, did the family thing, but we didn't go to church for years because she felt so ashamed.
I know people right now who are not attending church because they've been divorced. And their hearts are breaking. They want to be there, but they feel ashamed for having gotten pregnant before they got married or for being divorced. Or do you, any of you know people like that?
I notice that people leave the church when they're in their time of trouble instead of being able to come there and get compassion.
And I think it's more true for our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters because they feel more hurt and excluded and ruled out.
Nobody will talk to them.
Is that the case in your parishes, that people don't talk to them?
But going back to the unwed mother or young parents that aren't married, I'm happy to see now that they have been baptized publicly during the service. You know, that's printed in the book, maybe with one name, even if you'd like to see that.
Good. Do you think that you, in your sense of what it's right to do in a partnership, in a home, a long-term partnership, that you are controlled a lot by your grandparents and parents, by the models that you grew up in? Do you want to say anything about that, the kind of modeling that we've been given?
There are certain things we don't talk about.
In your family, there's certainly, you know, in every family that's true, obviously. So, do you want to say what they are in your family? No, we don't talk about them. Right. And it would be on tape if you talked about it here and someone might find out.
I sometimes think that maybe we have as much distortion of what they really were than what they were. We have an image of how we wanted them to be or act, and that wasn't always true.
Is it possible that that's the case with your children?
They keep wondering how we're still married. I mean, not that we have a problem, but none of their other friends still have parents who are married. And so they always ask us how, and we can never answer that. What did you do right?
Well, we'll get back to you on that because we need some expertise in that area. I wish that we all would keep journals and be disclosing in our journals so that we could read what our parents and grandparents had thought and really were feeling, and that our children could read what we were and our brothers and sisters. I think that one of the ways that we get some wisdom is through old wives' tales, and I just wanted to briefly bring up, there's this book here called The Old Wives' Tales Fairy Tale Book. And I read through this whole book with this question in mind. It was fun to read. It wasn't onerous to do that. But one of the things that is real clear is that in old wives' tales, there's a lot of sexism. You know, there are assumptions about roles and appropriate roles in the culture. But this is typical. I'll read you a little bit of this one. This is a Norwegian old wives' tale. There was once a man so surly and cross that he never thought his wife did anything right in the house. So one evening, in haymaking time, he came home scolding and swearing and showing his teeth and making a dust. "Dear love, don't be so angry. There's a good man," said his goody. "Tomorrow, let's change our work," said she. "I'll go out with the mowers and mow, and you shall mind the house at home." "Yes," the husband thought that would do very well. He was quite willing, he said. So early next morning, his goody took a sigh over her neck and went out into the hayfield with the mowers and began to mow. But the man was to mind the house and do the work at home. First of all, he wanted to churn the butter. But when he had churned a while, he got thirsty, so went down to the cellar to tap a barrel of ale. They had more serious problems than they knew. So So just when he had knocked in the bung and was putting the tap into the cask, he heard overhead the pig come into the kitchen. Then off he ran up the cellar steps with a tap in his hand as fast as he could to look after the pig, lest it should upset the churn. But when he got up and saw the pig had already knocked the churn over and stood there, grouting and grunting amongst the cream, which was running all over the floor, he got so wild with rage that he quite forgot the ale barrel and ran at the pig as hard as he could. He caught it, too, just as it ran out of doors, and gave it such a kick that Piggy lay for dead on the spot. And it goes on that way for a while, and then he says, let's see, where is it? But by now it was near dinner time, and he hadn't even got the butter yet, so he thought he'd best boil the porridge and filled the pot with water and hung it over the fire. When he had done that, he thought the cow might perhaps fall off the thatch and break her legs or her neck, so he got up on the house to tie her up. On one end of the rope he made fast to the cow's neck, and the other he slipped down the chimney and tied round his own thigh. And he had to make haste, for the water now had begun to boil in the pot, and still he had to grind the oatmeal. So he began to grind away, but while he was hard at it, down fell the cow off the housetop after all, and as she fell, she dragged the man up the chimney by the rope. There he stuck fast, and as for the cow, she hung halfway down the wall, swinging between heaven and earth, for she could get neither down nor up. And now the goody had waited 7 lengths and 7 breaths for her husband to come and call them home to dinner, but never a call they had. At last she thought she'd waited long enough and went home. But when she got there and saw the cow hanging in such an ugly place, she ran up and cut the rope in two with her side. But as she did this, down came her husband out of the chimney. And so, when his old dame came inside the kitchen, there she found him standing on his head in the porridge pot. And those are, I mean, this whole book is full of sort of delightful stories, but lots of stories about gender roles like that, and it's really quite fun. But it tells you that we've been given this. This is a heritage. This is stuff that, these are stories that people have told for generations, and they're from every culture. It's an extremely multicultural book. It's sort of fun. So that is, I mean, I think that we have some gender-specific instructions in our heritage that I would like us to take a look at in terms of how we do develop long-term relationships. I think what I would like to do next is go to the list, what my husband and I call the list, and do a little bit of that, and then see whether when we're constructing such a list, we would find that there were some underlying principles that made us either uncomfortable or excited. So let me just tell you briefly what we have done, what we did 25 years ago or something, a long time ago, and have revised and worked on from time to time. We work on something called the list, and it is trying to think of all the work that we have to do in our lives, all the things that have to get done. And when we think of those things and kind of raise them all to consciousness, then it seems like two adults working together to make a home work have more of the assumptions about what's involved here on the surface, on the table. And it's helpful to have the assumptions on the table because otherwise, for a long time, for example, I didn't realize that one of the things on the list was tending to. And tending to in this case meant things like making dentist appointments and tending to repairs of things and, you know, kind of management stuff that somebody had to take responsibility to think about. Now, you notice I have children down here. Children are exponentially more complicated. All of these things get worse and harder and more complicated once you've got children. But just without children, they're all major issues, I think. For example, under home, what would you put? First of all, you'd have to buy one. Or rent one. Find one somewhere. But once you had one, which would be work to begin with, what was your suggestion?
Oh, the cleaning.
Cleaning. You'd have to clean it.
Decorate it.
No, there are different kinds of cleaning. Let's stay with cleaning for a minute. What kind of cleaning do you do?
Well, do I...
Or does someone do in your house?
Well, vacuuming, dusting.
There's routine cleaning.
Floors, yeah, bathrooms.
There's sort of weekly cleaning. Or first of all, there's daily cleaning.
Daily.
There's, for example, dishes. Beds, if you want to do beds. There's picking up, if you want to do picking up. So there's daily cleaning. That's one kind of cleaning. And I think it's a different personality than a person who cleans under the claw-footed tub twice a year. Yeah. You know, that sort of the deep, major... And that goes on the list, too. So there's cyclical daily, there's cyclical weekly, there's cyclical seasonally, there's spring cleaning, for example. There's cleaning when, for example, my children for a while slept in L-shaped bunk beds. And the one on the top at one point ate an enormous spaghetti dinner and got sick in the night and dumped it all on the one in the bottom. And so who cleans that at 3 a.m? You know, when it's a child who's dirty, it's the bedclothes, it's the floor, it's, you know, so they're cleaning and there's cleaning and cleaning and cleaning.
So cleaning.
So what our family did under those circumstances was dissolve in laughter until tears ran down our face. Three of us, the sick child and her father and I, and then eventually woke up the sleeping child who was under the mess.
That you've got leaves and gutters and all that outside.
Yes,
stuff.
Outside cleaning, yeah. And the sidewalk and the... So cleaning is...
It's organizing. I mean, also, who's going to decide who's how to organize?
Who's going to decide that it gets cleaned? Or is, you know, you could go through a period of saying every time one of the adults in the home lies down to read the newspaper, the other one will lie down and read the newspaper, and you know, a sort of form of mirroring behavior, so that nothing would get done unless both people were doing it, if that were your agreement, for example.
You know, there also seems to be another dimension of home. It's like, if you buy a home, like, where you're going to locate, or whether or not be close to the family of origin or further away, or but then also, like, growing up in the suburbs, like most of the person choose to live in their city, like in downtown areas. I mean, there's a lot of, even the location of that home can be a point of.
And researching the location, if you're moving to a new city or deciding whose family you're going to live closer to or further from, all of that kind of thing. And then maybe one of you would like old Victorian homes and one would like a modern condo. And so it's decisions and negotiating and who's going to organize the negotiations, which goes under good process. But that's part of home, too. So, it's part of home. What else goes under home? You had an idea.
About decorating.
Decorating, sure. And who's going to paint? Or are you going to hire a painter? And how do you figure out furniture? Who's going to buy it? Are you going to buy it secondhand? You're going to buy it new?
How high should the pictures be on the wall?
At my eye height or somebody else's eye height?
How far the bookshelf should be moved?
Right. And who gets what room?
Who decides paint colors and wallpaper patterns?
The configuration, too.
Configuration of it?
Of furniture, what you use various rooms for.
And then if you're going to have the configuration of furniture include a couch lined up with a television set, who gets to lie on that couch?
This is too impossible to do.
Somebody it's only the first item on the list.
Right, it's only the first item on the list.
And some people don't have an adequate home to deal with. If you live in a high-rise in the inner city and you're all together, how do you divide if you don't have a lot either?
Right, they become fewer and fewer choices. Mm-hmm. Well, and then there are homeless people. And I mean, so that's, you know, and that goes on. I mean, I'm quite good friends with a homeless man named James who lived in a perfectly good home, and then it burned, and so he was out of it. And his wife is in a homeless shelter with her family, and he's on the, he sleeps under the loading dock at my building where I work. So we're very privileged to be able to having this conversation. What else goes into home?
Repairs.
Repairs. that's really important. And it can go to degradation of the value of the home or not getting your down payment back for your apartment when you move. And there are a lot of, they're very time consuming, and you can do repairs badly or well. You can do them yourself. You can hire them done. You can hire them done badly or well. So all of that stuff you can put on the list. Who's gonna tend to that? Who's gonna find the people who are up to the task, and who's gonna arrange for them, and who's gonna stay home from work to be there for them? Anything else under home?
The yard work.
Yard work. And yard work you could break down.
I'm thinking holidays, decorating and doing all the holiday kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. Yes, taking down the Christmas decorations. Somehow I have a feeling another one of my things on our list is tending, under tending to, is family rituals. And I think it's a good idea to make a family ritual that's fun out of taking down the Christmas decorations. Otherwise, they're never going to get it done. We have had them up in April in our house. We like Christmas, but at some point it's getting to be neglect. Other home items that you want to add in here. You get the idea about home. Food is equally complicated. You have to purchase it. You have to decide things about food. When you come out of Olden Village, you always want to cook low in the food chain, which means you have to start a crock pot before you go to work in the morning with your lentils cooking. you know, you have to decide healthy or not healthy food. Or how quickly, if you have people in your family who like junk food, are you going to sort of cave into that, or are you going to hold the line and say, this is going to be a healthy family? So food is controversial. I mean, food involves more decisions that two people have to agree on or should agree on, unless you decide that it's one person's job. Then there's no negotiating that needs to be done. You can say it's one person's job, and that person gets to say. So we'll get to that. We'll talk about whether it is one person's job. But just to get the idea, we'll go a little bit further down this line. Cars, you can imagine deciding how much money you're going to spend on them, deciding who gets to say, deciding how many, deciding if when one of you is going through a midlife crisis, it's okay to have a little red convertible, deciding if when you have, if you have children, it's okay to have an enormous big van, or if you're going to use public transportation or rent. So all that stuff. And then there's all the repair stuff and the maintenance stuff. There's checking to see if the tires are bad before you go on a trip and get it tuned up. And, you know, you have to think through a lot of stuff. I mean, there's a lot around, many of these things are just around stuff. Purchasing stuff is the same thing. Everything from toothpaste to shoes to curtains to all the stuff you have to buy. Bibles. Vacations. I think vacations are one of the places where all of this really breaks apart. I mean, I think vacations can be just deadly. Because, especially if you have children, they're deadly. Because you both want to go on vacation, and all of your kids' support services are taken out from under them. They don't have their stuff, their toys, their friends, their resources, and they want your attention. And if they're little, they require your attention. I mean, if you're going to a beach, one of you has got to be sitting up with their eyes open watching kids the whole time, or they'll be dead. You know, what kind of a vacation is that? You can tell my issue. You can tell. I've been very specific on this point in the past.
I have this buy stuff. That's probably a big stressor in my household. I have three children. And I really don't believe you should buy one thing unless you really need it. And so my kids, they go to these garage sales. People give them stuff. And they just come home with tons of junk. So I think, well, should they give something else of theirs away before they can have another item in the house? Or
wow.
Stressful for me. Then you find it around the house. The junk.
And that makes you the police?
Yes.
And it also makes you the madam of storage. So there's all that. So you understand the list. You know, and I think some of the most sensitive issues on it are tending to things, including tending to the emotional health of everybody in the household, being attentive to that, tending to sex. Those of us who are in sexual relationships with our partners, that we can screw up really easily. I mean, you can say how often, how good, how are we going to set aside time? What about romance leading to sex? What about if you are sort of a slam bam, thank you ma'am sort of person, and I'm a sort of romance, let's spend a long time working up to this person, then how are we going to negotiate that out and compromise? I mean, I think sex is a terrific, you know, wonderful gift from God that we tend to be uncomfortable working out. And I think in a long-term relationship, if you don't work it out, you're going to be in trouble. It's not good. But it's not something that we are easily given to talking about. So I read poetry about it instead. Somebody else's words always help. Adrian Rich is good on sex. Dialogue. She sits with one hand poised against her head, the other turning an old ring to the light. For hours, our talk is beaten like rain against the screens. A sense of August and heat lightning. I get up, go to make tea, come back. We look at each other. Then she says, and this is what I live through over and over. She says, I do not know if sex is an illusion. I do not know who I was when I did those things, or who I said I was, or whether I willed to feel what I had read about, or who in fact was there with me, or whether I knew even then that there was doubt about these things. This one is called The Middle-Aged. Now, I'm middle-aged, and I don't think this is about the middle-aged. I think this is about somebody else, but not me. But I might not be middle-aged. I might be old. I'm 51. Their faces, safe as an interior of Holland tiles and oriental carpet, where the fruit bowl, always filled, stood in a light of placid afternoon. Their voices measure, their figures moving in the Sunday garden to lay the tea outdoors or trim the borders, afflicted, haunted us. For to be young was always to live in other people's houses, whose peace, if we sought it, had been made by others, was ours at second hand and not for long. The custom of the house, not ours, the sun fading, the silver-blue Fortinet curtains, the reminiscence of a Christmas party of 14 years ago, all memory, signs of possession and of being possessed. We tasted, tense with envy. They were so kind, would have given us anything. The bowl of fruit was filled for us. There was a room upstairs we must call ours. But 20 years of living they could not give, nor did they ever speak of the coarse stain on that polished balustrade, the crack in the study window, or the letters locked in a drawer and the key destroyed. All to be understood by us, returning late in our own time, how that peace was made, upon what terms, and how much left unsaid. So we do get something good out of making these long-term relationships. We have something when we've had them for a while. And I think the thing that we would like to, that I'd like us to turn our attention to next is the process. How do you deal with a process of getting? When you talk about this list, you're talking about something that is concrete and helpful and evocative because it brings out stuff in your head. It helps you discover what you believe or what you think. But it doesn't get to something deeper. And I think what this list does for me is teach me in part how little any of that matters. It gives me I mean, there's a part of me that says it matters terribly because I want my relationship to be fair and egalitarian and balanced, and I don't want to do work that I think he should do, or I don't want to take away from him his opportunity to be a grown-up and take care of himself and his family. And I don't want him to take that away from me. I don't want either one of us to be dependent on the other in pathological ways. I don't want us to be a sort of twisted pair of people who feed into each other's pathologies. I want us to be able to say, this is all work that we can do together. But it's all work that I can do alone, too. It's all work that I can do if you're ill, if you're away, if you're writing a book. I can say, okay, for the next 18 months, I will do it all. I can give that gift in my family. I don't have to say, I'm going to pay attention to the balance sheet at every jot and tittle. I'm going to say, well, I've put in 4 hours of work here, and so you have to put in 4 hours of work here. I mean, I think we all have much more generous notions. I mean, the first person who said something tonight said love. We're supposed to love one another. And part of my notion of that is that first you come to understand what's involved in living together, and then you say, I'll let it go. I won't tie myself to that place. Because it's too painful to keep lists on the refrigerator of saying how many hours you did or what's fair all the time. I mean, who cares what's fair all the time, you know? But on the other hand, if it's not in balance at all, then you got to get back to the list. And so we do. We raise the list back up every few years and sort of re-examine how it is. And new things get added to the list. And obviously children complicate it terribly. But I'm much more interested in the process. So I wonder if you want to suggest ideas that you have about when you have disagreements. Actually, I want to go back one more moment to the list. What are some of the underlying things that it raises up for you when you think about this? How does this make you angry? Or how does this make you uncomfortable? The list.
You don't have anything on it about people's work, which is interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Just a thought.
Yeah, that is a whole other piece of it. How do you give to one another's work? I mean, this is stuff in the home. But then I started out reading that poem about work. And surely one of the main things that we have, most of us in our relationships now have in common is both paid work outside the home, volunteer work, and work as work in the home. What makes you angry, Bruce?
I think what it kind of reminds me of is that there will be conflict. And so part of, at least for me, is a acceptance that that's a reality, that's good, and it's through the conflict then that we resolve. We learn to use the conflict to enhance the relationship rather than to destroy the relationship.
Mm-hmm. And if we find we can do conflict together, we feel some kind of satisfaction, I think, knowing that we can solve problems together and we can disagree with each other and still be safely within the circle of our love.
It's the concept of conflict as property, that it's something that we own within our relationship.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Conflict is property. What about other reactions to the list?
Pressure.
Mm-hmm. Say more about that.
Well, I've been away from home for 3 weeks, and I'm thinking about getting back to all this stuff. And I said, oh my gosh. Yeah, it's just a lot of pressure to get all of those things mm-hmm. done. I mean, even working together, and I'm kind of thinking of my poor wife having to do all that stuff right now herself, the pressure she's probably feeling while I'm gone. There is a lot of pressure to get the stuff done.
Statistically, it is the case still that women do most of the stuff in the home. If you say that all the people who do research on this subject find families where both spouses work, this is for heterosexual couples. Both spouses work, and the woman does something like 75% or 80% or 85%, some high percentage of the amount of housework in the home. So
the management and care of the home and care of all the stuff involved there. So does that raise up anything for you? I mean, it is really a problem.
For me, it's a lot of responsibility because my mom just did it. Uh-huh. And so it's the responsibility of me not just doing it, uh-huh. but negotiation.
Uh-huh.
And the work that's involved in negotiating to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it just seems easier, fine, I'll just clean the bathroom and get it over with, instead mm-hmm. of going through the negotiation.
Anybody else?
Well, the 75% sounds great to me in our relationship, but what I wonder about is, can we still get to resolution without knee-jerking to get to regulation?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Really helpful question, I think.
I think what you said about the grace-filled home, in the sense of not keeping the balance sheet, is important. What I struggle with, and I guess some of what my anger comes out of, is that the role models that were given to me came out of an agrarian kind of setup. My father was a farmer for half of his life, and so consequently, when they were on the farm, obviously my mother and my father had very different roles in terms of keeping that farm going, and it seemed that it was right that it should be that way, and it seemed comfortable to them, and they didn't question it.
Mm-hmm.
It just had to be that way in order to make the farm work. But leaving that agrarian society, all of a sudden, you enter into a relationship, but you've got those role models that you grew up with. How you expand out of that and leave it, it's not always an emotional issue in many ways in dealing with that.
I have three really dear friends who are my exact age. They were my college friends, women who also did the plowing and combining and stuff. So I think that is less stereotypically broken down by gender than we think it is, too. So what about this anger?
I was going to say, it's sort of common. It seems to me that the changing in the list, I mean, the things on the list have always been there, but the way they're different for us today than they were, 20 years ago. So the changes in the list have been happening a lot more quickly than the changing in good process.
Mm-hmm.
So that what used to be good process no longer applies in the same way to what the list demands of us. So I think the anger comes from the fact, for me, that the tools we have don't seem to apply to the issues that are before us.
There are new role models that have come out probably the last two decades, change where different levels of the medium between couples and who work out the different programs.
Can you give an example of your point? I don't understand it very well.
An agrarian society, I think as a culture, agrarian society's been around a long, long time. And the assumptions of what a spouse or husband or wife did were not renegotiated. And my age, marriage, you renegotiate all the stuff on the list, which is a task in itself to add that to the list. You're responsible for starting the renegotiations of this stuff, on and on and on. And my stereotype of good process in less complicated times were that you didn't have to renegotiate these things, or weren't allowed, maybe more accurately, the privilege of renegotiating these things. The comment about affluence, I think, is really well taken.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have to worry about who got to do this or that, because if you didn't both do what was in front of you, the family collapsed, or survival collapsed.
But of course, there were variations in that all the time.
Sure,
deaths
sure
happened.
But I think this, for me in my life, the affluence brings an ability to, which did not used to be there, for better or for worse, and therefore good process, what kind of tools do you bring to the ability to, when you haven't dealt with that for generations, good process.
I wonder whether anybody has, especially the men, but also the women, have anger around this list because you have a sense that you're assigned something that you don't necessarily choose. And you don't have much choice about that. Like men are assigned to drive long distances on family vacations and be the driver, even if they're tired or they're sick or they have a bad back or whatever.
And maybe women would prefer to do that driving or do the bulk of it or share it. If we're assigned roles by gender, that, I mean, is it a sin, you know, received in our received consciousness of what's okay to be and do, to say, well, he ought to be doing the childcare or the cooking or the, you know, I wonder if gender stuff enters in here. And if, or if a marriage breaks up, that people would say, well, naturally that marriage broke up because she made him do all the work.
Looking at that list, I would not have assumed, based on gender, who was going to do what, but based more on our individual personalities. However, in my sister's marriage, which I think is a good marriage, she enjoys cooking, really enjoys the cooking. Mm-hmm. But she almost resents that it's a woman's thing to do, and she's the one doing it, although I know she loves to do it. Mm-hmm. And it's almost flipped back.
Mm-hmm. That's where I think people that I talk to go frustrated and just the opposite. Now that everything's kind of open, I feel like I can't do those traditional female things. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, even in terms of establishing a relationship, I'm kind of involved with someone who lives in a different city and has a job, and I live in a different city and have a job. My heart would like to quit my job, move there, even though I don't have a job, to be with him. And yet I feel like, no, that's been the traditional women's role. Women can't do that, you know. And so I struggle with those kind of issues. Anytime, I would probably like to do a lot of the traditional female things and don't do it because they're traditional. And
they're
just replacing that, so it's really a struggle.
Oh, good. We're trapped. We can't. When I feel like my life is out of control, I can no longer clean to get it back into control because it's too traditional for me to do that. I don't feel it exactly. Glenn has been trying to get into this conversation.
I ran across some really depressing statistics that was compiled by a UN project that women do something on the order of 65% to 75% of the world's work. In part, there are quite a few societies where the male roles, the actual tasks, many of them have disappeared. And so the men are hanging out in the cafes drinking and probably not being leading that satisfying a life, but leaving a disproportionate amount of the work, you know, to the women who are traveling longer distances to carry the firewood back or bring the water or do the shopping or do small crafts to try to bring a little cash in addition to the subsistence farming and so forth. And I guess it's harder to see in my own relationship, but when, you know, that's pretty stark. And I think it suggests that we men need to get our act together a little bit here and sit down with one another and give ourselves some support to, you know, apart from just the negotiation with the within the marriage, but to do some thinking about what's going on here. And I think that process begins with not blaming ourselves and to, like, taking the tack. You know, no one ever asked us males permission to be socialized in these sorts of unequal mm-hmm. kinds of roles, and, like, give ourselves permission to start new, but then take some responsibility for doing some changes that may be a little harder than what we would opt for if it was just simply a negotiation with our partner, where I think a lot of times it ends up unequal.
Yeah, I think men have a lot to gain from some of these changes. There was a hand over here.
Oh, I was just thinking control is such a big one. If you lose control over who has the control in any of these tasks, and trying to mm-hmm. negotiate it.
Who gets to say?
And powerlessness, and they can work, both partners can feel powerlessness. And
I think a lot of compromise is required in the task area. I quit looking at the backs of our plates a long time ago because my husband does all the plate washing, all the washing dishes, and he doesn't wash the backs of them, so. I tried once to point out that plates lay on top of each other in the backs of one touch the. But I just decided he does them, and nobody's sick. We're all fine. Now, in case any of you ever come to dinner in my house, I should say we've gotten a dishwasher since then.
Kaiser Medical, which we belong to, HMO, put out a bulletin last week, kind of man to man. As a man, you need to be aware of the following health things. But what was really important was the last one, and that is bringing up your children, getting your priorities right. I mean, here's the thing dealing with medicine, your heart, your prostate, your blood pressure, all these other things. Yet the last article in this bulletin said you need to participate in bringing up the children, taking time to be a father. And if you don't, society will crumble. So it's kind of basic. I read it about three times. Kaiser's putting out something like this, and the last thing is you need to get a new role in each day.
Mm-hmm. Great.
June. One thing that I noticed that was not on the list, I don't know if you excluded on purpose or what, but just fun, recreation.
Mm-hmm.
I know a couple who does work in counseling couples.
I actually had it over here, but on my list of this.
Okay.
But you're right, it's extremely important.
I know a couple who works with couples and relationships, and they advocate a series of what they call the five F's, and one of the F's is obviously fun. And they say to people, you should really build your own doghouse. In other words, you should have your own arena, your own space in the house, in the home, or whatever, your own thing to do. And I wonder, we're talking a lot about our gender roles and how we work and everything. I wonder, would we answer our questions better if we just asked ourselves, when are we having fun? When does the one person have, the one person in a relationship have time to relax?
That's a good question to ask, but I think in relationships where there's a lot of imbalance and exhaustion on the part of one of the partners, it's not a very relevant question. I mean, it's surely important to get to the place where you can do that, but there's so much other stuff for lots of people first. I think in a lesbian relationship or a gay relationship, it's helpful to look at some of our friends who are in those relationships, because they kind of can work out the balance of stuff without gender considerations, and I think that frees them up to think about what are my gifts and what are your gifts. I mean, it's possible to argue that your gift is cleaning the bathroom and mine isn't. But then you could, then the other person could say, well, it's going to become your gift. I'm a good teacher, and I can. So let's spend a few minutes on this process stuff. I want to say a couple of things about process. I think that it's a good idea to talk to each other pretty regularly. And I think in all of our busy lives, it's very easy to let that go. And you can say, well, we're together every day, we see each other every day, we love each other. But if there's we don't do this all the time, but we do periods of time where we're aware of things being in transition or having changed, you know, a kid has come, a kid has gone, a work situation has changed, or something has changed. I think a regularly scheduled talk time is helpful. We do Sunday nights, other people could do, you know, and I think also having a date regularly with your loved one, your partner, is a good idea. To say, let's go out and do something fun together every Saturday or every other Saturday, just us, not with friends, or sometime. But anyhow, I would say begin regular times to talk. And if you're freshest in the morning and you have hard things to talk about, I'd recommend the morning. And if one of you freaks out at these talks and bolts out of the house, as a woman I was talking to in the dining hall a couple days ago said that her husband does, she starts a talk, he hangs in there for 8 minutes or something, and then he's gone. You can make a deal and say, let's set the timer and we'll talk for 10 minutes. And then we'll stop. But you need regular times to talk, I think, to work it out. My second one is always, you need regular times to have fun, which we've already got down here. And those times, I think you should say, if you're in conflict, if you're having a hard time dealing with one of these issues, we're not going to talk about it. We're going to have fun. We're not going to talk about it. In fact, we sometimes have said, We are not going to talk about this at all, ever, except at designated times. For the next 6 months, even, or at least for the next month, or because, and then we set up enough designated time so that we feel satisfied and that neither of us feels oppressed by it. We did that when we were trying to decide if we were going to get married. Betsy, you know those days. It was a long time ago. Because we would wonder, now is he not bringing it up or is she not bringing it up? Because, and does that mean something? Or, you know, so then we just
decided. Well, he just announced it. Remember that?
Opie announced it.
Yeah, remember he had a party and his her father-in-law just announced they were getting married and you said, no, we're not.
I don't remember. Sounds like Opie though.
Yeah.
Well, we did want to get married before he died and he was sort of getting ready to die, so there was some of that. So he did have his way there. But I think that agreeing not to talk about it is as important as agreeing to talk about it. Because you don't want to have it sort of making you crazy in your whole life, whatever it is.
Do you want to start? No, I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. So that would be another little thing that we've found works for us. And then we always say, well, let's try to figure out a length of time that we're going to take to deal, to get somewhere with whatever the issue is. If we're trying to make a change in our way of being together, or make a change, or make a decision about something, like a decision to take a different job, or to have kids, or a decision to move, or a decision to whatever, go into counseling. You can say, you can make it time limited, so the thing doesn't just hang over you forever. And I think that both people can often relate to that kind of a sense of orderliness about it, or something that if you get it out in the open and say, I can't stand the tension of wondering when you're going to bring it up, or I can't stand the tension of these long, heavy 2-hour, 3-hour, 4-hour discussions, then you need to compromise and say, okay, we'll do it a different way. What could you deal with? You know, given the fact that we have this thing like an elephant between us, what can you deal with in terms of dealing with it, getting somewhere with it? What are some other suggestions? What have other people found works for them?
Regular exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Staying in good health so you have the energy to deal with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Make the work fun. Enjoy the process.
Put on good music when you're cleaning house. Is that what you mean?
Maybe.
Like us having a family ritual around taking the Christmas decorations down.
That's right.
Good food, everybody's favorite food.
You need community around you to support you too.
Thank you. That is so important. And I think that she said, we need community around you to support you. And that's sort of problematic for some of us.
It's hard to come by.
It's hard to come by unless you work at developing and building it. For some of us, I think I was given the sense when I was growing up as a Norwegian American that we just didn't talk about our stuff in public. You know, in public meant outside the door of our house. So then what do you mean by community? You have to think pretty carefully about how you do that.
And what's healthy and what isn't.
Uh-huh. Because you don't want to betray stuff either and kind of undermine your health at home by talking too much.
As I was thinking about, isn't there some African proverb that says it takes a community to raise a child?
Yeah.
It takes a supportive community.
I think that's one of the really important differences between a gay and lesbian couple struggling with these issues and a heterosexual couple who has the option of getting married. Because marriage gives you the support of a community. The community says, we take this relationship seriously, we will invest in it, we will help you with it, we will honor it. We think that your relationship is important and to be honored. And a gay or lesbian relationship is much more underground and not nearly as celebrated publicly and not taken as seriously. Assumed it could be broken up at the slightest whim, which is a real crime. I mean, it's makes it much harder to survive in a relationship if you're not supported by your community. I think that what we need to do and don't do enough of, and almost are told by our culture that we shouldn't do, is work at community building.